Welcome to the Always Better Than Yesterday podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Hartley. This podcast exists to equip and inspire your heart-centered leadership. Every week, we bring interviews with some of the greatest heart sets and mindsets on the planet. I hope the heartprint of our time spent together is that it creates new possibilities for you and all those you come into contact with. If you'd like to explore what we could make possible for you, then head to abty.co.uk/connect and book in a free 30-minute call to begin our journey. On episode 255, I welcome Dr. Robert Glover to the podcast. Dr. Robert is a relationship expert with over 40 years of professional experience. You might well know him as the author of the groundbreaking book, No More Mr. Nice Guy. Dr. Robert has helped thousands of men worldwide transform their lives and get what they want in relationship, sex, and their career. It's a fascinating conversation, one I cannot wait for you to hear. It's episode 255 with Dr. Robert Glover. Dr. Robert Glover, welcome to Always Better Than Yesterday podcast. How are you, brother?
I'd say good morning to you, but it's afternoon your time. I'm well. It's always fun to get up early in the morning and have a conversation.
No, I appreciate you taking the time out of your day. And I just wonder, like, with your book, you know, it's been in the world over 22 years.
Yeah.
Man, culture's doing a good job at creating more nice guys for you to tackle.
Yeah, just an interesting observation is that when I first started working with nice guys, as I define them, you know, men that are passively pleasing, trying to become what they think other people want them to be, hiding anything about them they think might get a negative reaction. You know, it was probably close to 30 years ago. And a lot of the men I was working with, you know, probably closer to my age now, you know, older guys. And a lot of what they said is, you know, especially talking about their families, that, you know, dad was either gone because of divorce or angry and not safe or alcoholic or working all the time, just never there. And kind of mom ran the show. What I'm hearing from a lot of men nowadays is, and this to me kind of illustrates the difference, a lot of the younger men I work with say, guys, my son's aging down. My son's 38. Is they say, oh, my dad was a nice guy. And all he taught me about being a man was don't piss off your mother. Because that's what he was trying to, you know, not do, is not piss off, you know, my mom.
So
not only did we have, I think, a number of cultural dynamics since, say, World War II, specifically, that began to really create a lot of nice guys worldwide. But I think that now we've got dads training their sons to be nice guys and probably an educational system that's really contributing to that as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting because my son is of primary school age, kind of kindergarten type, I think is the age. And there's so much emphasis on, I think, feminism that it's almost sometimes shamed. The boy side of him is shamed that anything that is, you know, one of his teachers referred to him as being sexist. And I was like, wow, like that's a heavy label for an 11-year-old to carry, you know?
Yeah, it starts getting scary. And, you know, and again, I'm not a big fan of playing victim and bashing. Well, you know, it's their fault. You know, that kind of thinking, you know, Nazism began in that way. So I'm not a big fan of that. But I think we do have to be able to identify certain things. And I've had a lot of parents say, you know, my son came home from school and, you know, he heard the word toxic masculinity,
right?
You know, used to describe anything negative that little boys did. And you know, it's bigger than that. When I was in graduate school in the 1980s, or early 1980s, my teachers in child development, coming from a more feminist bent, we're already teaching back in the 80s that there's no such thing as gender. Gender is just a social construct imposed on little boys and little girls. You know, we make little boys not cry. We make little girls play with dolls. And then they would say, you know, gender is fluid. Well, gender can be fluid to a degree. But nowadays, a friend of mine that teaches sex education in school says, we teach the children that there are as many genders as there are people on the planet.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that helps confused little kids, especially during adolescence. And the other message I got in these child development courses, that it was, even while they're saying there's no such thing as gender, they're saying that the masculine tendencies of competition were bad. I mean, they just flat out said that. And none of this was scientific fact. It was just, you know, it was part of a kind of a doctrine that was growing in the university level at that time. And they said, basically, everything little girls do is cooperative. So that's good. So, you know, the educational system went that way, just to get rid of any kind of competition and go all towards cooperation. And with coming from a bent that those feminine traits were better, all the while saying there's no such thing as gender. And it's kind of funny, you're looking around now and you see a lot of cooperative, passive young men and a lot of competitive, aggressive young girls and women. So it's interesting how, you know, maybe just we've just flipped things. Nothing's maybe changed. We just, you know, flipped who's playing the cooperative and who's playing the competitive role.
Yeah. Well, I'd just like to take a moment to thank you for the amount of cognitive dissonance you put me through reading your book.
the amount of times are you one of those people that kept putting it down because you couldn't read it, or you couldn't put it down?
I'm listening intently because I feel like I'm enough through a journey where I can look back and go, oh man, I could have done with you 10 years ago in my life. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Because I've unfortunately learned some lessons and some wisdom through maybe the suffering and the struggling that you'd be familiar with within the book. My wife and I've been together since we were 15, so we've been married, you know, we've been together 21 years, right? And my wife has had to suffer me as boy, man boy, emerging man, and you know, so when I share with her my learnings, we can both put that younger version of me in the middle and have a bit more compassion for that. Man, like there's some interesting behaviors that maybe those are some of the roots. Grow up single parent family, mum ran the show, several jobs. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from. I am all ears for your work. I've shared it with a number of people within our men's group that we run at Always Better Than Yesterday. And it is really speaking to the heart of men. But first, it brings this cognitive dissonance up. It brings up this, oh, well, what's wrong with being a nice guy?
The title brings up a cognitive dissonance. And, you know, I did that on purpose, you know. It was kind of an evolution. You know, when I first started looking at this dynamic that I now call nice guy syndrome, it began with me. My second wife, you know, basically said, you know, everybody thinks you're such a nice guy, but you're not. You know, you can be mean to me. You can be passive aggressive. You can embarrass me. You can hurt me in public. And she said, you know, basically, I'd rather be with an asshole. Because I know an asshole is going to be an asshole all the time. You know, you hear you are treating me well, and then out of the blue, you know, you're mean to me. And she goes, you need help. And I thought, well, you know, you're the one that's moody all the time and angry and never happy. Okay, I'll go get help. Luckily, I landed in some really good places and started discovering things like my toxic shame and how to begin to release toxic shame, the sense that I'm not good enough, I'm bad, I'm defective, I'm unlovable. Began to learn about, you know, making my needs a priority and asking for what I want rather than using what I call covert contracts, trying to manipulate people into giving me what I wanted. Started learning about honesty, you know, having integrity, speaking the truth, the whole truth, having transparency about what I wanted, what I felt, what I expected, what was bothering me. My ex used to say we'd have a big blow up. She'd call my victim pukes and she'd go, how long has it been bothering you? I go, I don't know, 6 months or so. She goes, you never thought to just tell me? I go, no, actually, it never crossed my mind to just say, this is bothering me. Can we have a conversation? Or can you stop doing that? Or can you do more of it? So kind of this began out of my own personal growth. Yeah. And I started in a 12-step group. I was going to then a therapist. And I was in a men's group for about 5 years. And I was a marriage and family therapist. So all of a sudden, I was noticing, maybe it was happening before, but guys were coming to me saying, I'm a nice guy. I'm one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. I treat my girlfriend, my wife, better than her ex. I'm raising her kids. I do everything for her. She's never happy. It's never good enough. When is it going to be my turn? I thought, well, hey, I'm not the only one. So I started a No More Mr. Nice Guy men's group. I started just writing stuff. And, you know, as guys said, and their wives and girlfriends, Robert, you should write a book. You should go on Oprah. This could be a bestseller. No pressure there. And then, so, you know, when I did shop the book and my agent said, well, maybe we should change the name. I go, non-negotiable. Because it is, you know, it's paradoxical. Because probably everybody has said, no more Mr. Nice Guy. You know, I'm not taking it anymore. But when you see that on the cover of a book, you see, why would someone write a book teaching men to be not nice? There's enough not nice guys out there. And then a lot of a lot of men, especially women, grasp it quickly. Women seem to get it quickly. They start, oh yeah, I know that guy. That's my dad, or that's my brother, or that's my ex. Guys go, am I going to become an asshole? Am I going to become a jerk? You know, women say they don't like assholes and jerks. I listen to a lot of them complain. And so men tend to think, well, that means I must go from being this like this wussy doormat over to this asshole that just treats everybody bad. And so, you know, once they get into No More Mr. Nice Guy, they realize that's not what it is. Because I think both the passive male and the aggressive male are just actually on the same continuum of trying to manage their anxiety. They're both in fight, flight, freeze.
Yeah.
The passive male's over here, you know, in flight and freeze. The aggressive guy, he's in fight. Now, so if we just find some place somewhere in the middle of that, there's no health in that. We have to rise above that. And that's where I think the change begins, where men learn to be differentiated. They learn to ask, what do I want? What feels right? What's important? They learn to self-soothe and act out and respond rather than react. They learn to have integrity. They learn to be honest. They learn to live with purpose and passion. So it's a big shift. And so not just the title creates that kind of cognitive dissonance. When your roadmap, since you were a little boy, says, be good. Don't be a moment's problem. Don't have needs. Put everybody else first. Don't rock the boat. Hide your sexuality. Don't talk about it. And then all of a sudden we're saying, embrace everything about you. Embrace your sexuality, your wants, your needs. Talk about it. You know, ask for what you want. All of a sudden guys are going, I'm going to die. People are going to kill me.
This is it, because it comes back to the root of it is quite often a childhood experience, this combination between abandonment and egocentricity of a child. Like what is the powerful combination of those two combined?
We'll get back into our child development a little bit more here. All children are born egocentric, narcissistic. I mean, it's not bad. It's a survival thing. They have to be all about me.
Yeah.
You mix that with, they're also totally dependent. You know, humans are the longest maturing animal to maturity of any animal, right? And that keeps getting longer. You know, in our grandparents' generation, 12, 14, they were out there, you know, being responsible. My generation is 18 to 21. Now it's like 35, you know, but before young men, you know, start taking on responsibility. So that keeps getting longer, that maturity of development. So what happens for every infant, because we're totally dependent on our caregivers to be attentive to us, to respond in timely, consistent, judicious ways, to feed us when we're hungry, to change us when we're dirty, to hold us when we're sad, to burp us when we got gas, to, you know, wrap us up if we're cold. We're totally dependent. And our thinking brain, our prefrontal cortex, it's just beginning to develop. Doesn't even become online enough to communicate with words till about 2. And doesn't finish developing in men till about age 25. So that means all this online is our emotional brain. It is just all survival. The amygdala that manages fight, flight, freeze, respiration, heart rate, that's fully functioning at birth. So everything that happens to a child gets internalized as an emotional memory. I call them abandonments from No More Mr. Nice Guy, but it's as simple as you're hungry and you don't get fed right away. You know, you're pooping your diaper and nobody's there to change it right away. You know, you're lonely and you're crying and nobody comes to pick you up. And it's not that even anybody abused you or abandoned you, but it felt uncomfortable. It felt painful. The child from that narcissistic state, and we're talking emotions here, not thought, internalizes what's wrong with me. Yeah, I'm the cause of that. And again, I'm putting it in words, even though it's not words, which is kind of hard to explain to people. It's kind of like people that have a spiritual experience and try to put it in words.
Yeah.
Can't do it.
It becomes a belief system or a paradigm, as you call it, I guess.
Yeah. It becomes a roadmap so it takes on two roles in every human being. And because of this narcissistic, I must be the cause of these painful things. Yeah. So what a child tries to do, again, without words, with a very primitive brain, almost like a brain of a puppy, you know, to just, number one, How do I soothe these feelings I'm having, these uncomfortable feelings? So some babies cry, some babies sleep, some babies eat, some babies stick their thumb in their mouth. I sucked my thumb till I was in kindergarten. You think maybe I was soothing uncomfortable feelings. Mm. So every child will do things to soothe the uncomfortable feelings.
Mm.
And it's like we develop a thermostat inside of us. You know, we have a thermostat in our room, and if the temperature gets too hot, too cold, it kicks in. Cools it off, warms it up. And if the thermostat's doing its job well, we don't even notice the temperature change, right?
Mm.
We have an emotional thermostat. Every human does. So that thermostat kicks in. Oh, make these feelings go away. The second thing every little infant's trying to do with a very primitive brain, not a thinking brain, is how do I prevent these uncomfortable experiences from happening in the future?
Mm-hmm.
Every child does this. Every child grows up to be an adolescent. And those same things are still in play in adolescent. How do I not feel bad? How do I prevent bad feelings? That gets cemented through adolescence into adulthood. Thermostat, how do I not feel bad? How do I prevent these bad feelings? That looks different in everybody. In the nice guy, it's that I'll become what I think other people want me to be, and I'll hide anything about me that might get a negative reaction. So I give to get, I hide my feelings, my needs, my wants, and you know, I try to be nice. Now, throw in that basic temperament. At times my mother would tell women I was dating. I mean, this is in adulthood. This is even probably as recently as, you know, my wife, who I've been married to for 7.5 years. She would, out of the blue at times, say, "Bobby never did like conflict." And I'm going, who in the hell likes conflict? I seem to marry women who do, but, you know, I don't. That's my temperament. I'm not a... you know, like I don't go around picking fights. I'd rather say, can we just talk about this? You know, why do we have to withdraw? Why do we have to get angry? Why do we have to yell? Why do we have to threaten? Let's just talk about it. That's my temperament, right? And so a lot of nice guys have a temperament that's pretty easygoing, right? And then you add that conditioning from childhood, and then maybe add cultural conditioning to it, and this is where we end up having podcasts talking about nice guys.
Yeah, well, I'm grateful we get to have this conversation, because there's so much of this is like, I really revel in the paradox, because the nice guy's not so nice. And, you know, I think it starts with, you know, the covert contracts, and then the victim triangle. Like, let's go there, shall we?
Yeah. And I lead in that really early in No More Mr. Nice Guy, because that maybe is the big stick upside the head of a lot of nice guys.
Yeah.
Is they go, I'm a nice guy. Well, why wouldn't people appreciate that? Why wouldn't people value that? Why wouldn't people appreciate and say, hey, way to go, you're a good guy. And instead, how come, you know, no good deed goes unpunished? Everything I try to do, you know, well, I get rejected, or I get yelled at, or I get accused of stuff. So, you know, we got two things here, both covert contracts and victim triangles. They're both good, so we'll talk about it. I'll start with covert contracts. One of the things that a lot of people, men and women, tell me that they get out of No More Mr. Nice Guy is that concept of the covert contract. And since writing the book, I've kind of even boiled it down a little bit cleaner. And most nice guys, and nice girls too. I mean, there's lots and lots of women following the same paradigm. Something wrong with me. I'm not good enough. I have to become what I think other people want me to be. I got to hide anything about me to get a negative reaction. And it may show up a little bit differently in men and women, but not all that much. A lot of women write me, say, I love your book. Thank you. And so the covert contracts, there's three of them for most nice guys. Most operate more in one than the other, but usually we have some degree of all three. The first one is, if I'm a good guy or a good girl, in that matter, I will be liked and loved. Now, where this plays out for a lot of nice guys, men, is that it also tied in there is sex. If I'm a good guy, you know, this woman I'm you know, using nice guy seduction on, let's say if he's single, oh, I'm listening to her talk about her problems. I'm different than her ex, the jerk she's complaining about. Oh, I'll make her first month's car payment for her because she's broke. You know, I'll do this. I'm a nice guy. She's going to like me and want to have sex with me. Then when she basically puts him in the friend zone, he goes, wait a minute. I did all of this, you know, you should want to, all the while he had his sexual agenda hidden completely from her. But if I'm a good guy, I'll be liked and loved. Covert contract number two. This is so sneaky. if I read your mind and give to you what you want without you having to ask, you will read my mind and give to me what I want without me having to ask. Now, the truth is, we're actually terrible mind readers. You know, we're giving to get, you know, we're caretaking versus caring. Caretaking is when I give to you what I need to give to you so that you'll value me and you'll be better. And caring is when I give what really benefits you the most.
Yes.
What do you really need in this moment?
No
strings attached, none. So that, and plus the other part of that covert contract number two, nice guys are terrible receivers because we think we're doing something wrong if we let people give to us. We're going to be in trouble. You know, we're going to owe them something. So, you know, I'm gonna be found out whatever.
Mm.
So that's covert contract number two. If I give to you without having to ask, you'll give to me without me having to ask.
Mm.
Covert contract number three is if I do everything right, then I will have a smooth, problem-free life. It's very Peter Pan-ish. You know, the world should be smooth and go the way I want it to all the time.
Mm.
You know, that's probably the little boy that your wife married. You know, oh, I'm going to throw a tantrum when things don't go the way I want them to because they're supposed to go the way I want them to. You know, I did A, therefore B should happen. Yeah, it's very simplistic first order thinking, but that's the covert contract of nice guys as well. But one of the problems is, you know, who does everything right and who's the decider of that? Nice guys have this big scoreboard in their living room. I did this right. I did this right. Oh, you did that wrong. Uh-oh, I'm winning. I'm winning. You know, the balance is out of whack. You can't bring anything up now because I've built up a bank account of good things I did right. So you can never, you know, point out any flaw in me. And because we do get kind of reactive if people criticize us or, you know, point out something maybe we could have done better. Or
listening to justify and defend.
There we go. I call that deer response. Defend, excuse, explain, and rationalize. And I've since added to that vindicate. I love vindicating myself. I didn't do that. You know,
I cannot confirm or deny I've ever taken that strategy.
So then what happens if we plug this into the victim triangle? Now, I've heard it called various things. I did not invent this. Covert contracts, I think, is original to No More Mr. Nice Guy. But the codependent triangle, victim triangle, you know, there's different names to it. There's three parts to it. And why it's illustrative is that most people don't realize they typically at some point play all three parts. You know, most people think it's fairly rigid, especially in codependent relationships. Well, we have the fixer, we have the fixee. But it's a little bit more when you add a third point in there. So you have the fixer. So the fixer, you know, oh, I'm going to do this for you. And you know, just to kind of zoom back a little bit, I don't use the word codependency in No More Mr. Nice Guy. And I did that on purpose because when I wrote the book, started writing it 30 years ago, the only context where people used the word codependency was either in partners of addicts, like, you know, spouses or family members of alcoholic drug addicts. And it had begun to be used, which is women's niceness, women who love too much, you know, Pia Melody, people like that were mainly writing to women in that codependent role. So I didn't use the term codependent because I really wanted to talk to men without people getting a preconceived idea and projection. So like, let's talk about this as a dynamic without putting, I put a term on it, nice guy syndrome, covert contracts, but it is codependency. And another term I really like for codependency, because it's really more descriptive and helpful, because most people go, what does codependency even mean? I like the term borrowed functioning, which means my identity, my value, my role, my reason for being is tied into you. I get value from my interaction with you. So my borrowed function is I get value as the helper, the fixer, the problem solver, the rescuer, the white knight, because you have problems. You have needs. You need fixed. I can come. I can help that, right? That's my role where I get a sense of value and identity. Now, of course, many problems with that role is one is it doesn't tend to get us what we want or need. It doesn't tend to attract competent people who can actually contribute to a relationship very well. Other problems is we get our entire value out of giving and you needing me. And another problem is that if you ever start getting better and don't need me anymore, I've lost a job. I'm unemployed. And so unconsciously, I will either need to keep you in that spot, or if you start getting better, I'll go find somebody else over here that needs me. And all of a sudden, the nice guy's caught up in an affair with some young single mother, or, you know, and his wife's going, what just happened? Wasn't it about sex? It was about borrowed functioning. I needed somebody who needed me. So going back to our victim triangle, you have the rescuer, and they're rescuing, and until all of a sudden it's not going the way we thought it should. And all of a sudden we become the victim. And when we've been victimized, I've been done too. I gave, I didn't get back. I got punished, you know. And then from that victim place, we tend to go into the persecutor. We lash out. We become, we have what I call victim pukes, where that, you know, that thing that's stored up for 6 months comes out. We become passive aggressive. Our anger gets directed indirectly. Or maybe we just even become out and out hostile. Then after we do that for just a little bit, because now all of a sudden that makes us really uncomfortable. Like, oh no, I'm going to get abandoned. I'm going to get in trouble. That makes me like dad. Yeah, that makes me like all right. The jerks. We go back over to rescuer again. Oh, I can fix that. Oh, we're apologizing. We're saying we're sorry. We're trying to make everything good. Everything all right? You okay? Can I do anything? We're back in, you know, that fixer role until that doesn't get appreciated or valued. And we go into victim role. I've been done too. From the victim role, we'll go into the persecutor role. Mm-hmm. And it just, and everybody involved moves through those three points. Rarely is one person just stagnant in any of those three.
That's powerful. One of the things that kind of came up as you were speaking was my previous guest, a chap called John Eldridge, who's written a number of books from a Christian perspective on masculinity.
And people will ask me about his books. And yeah. By the way, and I don't know him, but I come out of a fundamental Christian background. I have two degrees in religion, and I was a minister for 8 years. So I'm not religious now. But I really like Wild at Heart because I know how hard it must have been in a conservative, evangelical Christian environment to write that book. So I have great respect for John Eldridge and
I love that
Wild at Heart book.
Love that. One of the things that he said in my conversation with him is that if a man has no sense of self, he'll take that to the woman. And that's kind of what came up to me as you were speaking, because as a young man, I found this topic of leadership. I was quite effective. And when you're using management speak, it's like, oh, it's emotional intelligence, it's situational leadership. In reality, there was probably an undertone of like chameleon, social chameleon. And
okay,
there was
definitely
some elements of me taking that sense of self to my wife, my partner. Tell me who I am. Tell me you love me. Like the running joke has always been like, I'm needy, you know, and I think for me, it's words of affirmation. Like, tell me you love me. Tell me you need me.
And
tell us why that is deeply unattractive to women. Why is that repelling? Or maybe the opposite is, why is a sense of self really attractive?
Yeah. Well, let's come at it from both sides of it. Because men, at least the men I love working with men. My background, my doctorate's in marriage and family therapy. For 25 years, I had private practice working with couples and individuals, and then started leading men's groups. And so by the time 12 so years ago, when I kind of wrapped up private practice back in the States and moved to Mexico, I was leading 5 men's groups a week. Now I just, all my work's with men. So I love working with men, but men, we get black and white about stuff. And, you know, sometimes it takes a really big stick, you know. My most recent book is called The Big Stick, mainly because I say it so much that, you know, you can take a big stick upside men's head and they'll go, thank you. You know, I appreciate that. and so one of the things, so let's talk about the neediness first. Now I'm in my men's program, you know, you and I both got our t-shirts on, you know, so you're self-promoting. There we go.
Love it.
I'm actually teaching a series of lessons right now on getting your needs met and validating that, of course, we have needs. Of course, we have wants and how to get our needs met without being needy. Because I think probably most men have kind of heard that term. Well, you're so needy. You know, your neediness creeps me out, you know, things like that. And so all of a sudden that reinforces this thing. Well, I shouldn't have needs because it creeps women out. The problem is when men try to get anybody tries to get their needs met using those covert contracts, those indirect, manipulative strings attached I'll give this to you and you'll give back. I'll be the good guy and then you'll value me. All of those things, it's basically we're coming from this no sense of real self, like say, no real identity here, a chameleon. And we're coming for lack of, you know, this is probably the most functional way to put it. We got an empty bucket. Our bucket's empty. It's got a hole in the bottom. And we're going out there trying to get it filled in these indirect, passive ways. Now, I'll talk a little bit, back up a little bit, and talk a little bit about masculine-feminine polarity, masculine-feminine energies. To make it really simple, I define masculine as the doer. It's a very simple way of looking at it. And feminine is being done to. Masculine is internally validated through masterful action. Feminine is externally validated through attention, through desire, through praise, right? The feminine is that empty bucket with the hole in the bottom. I'm not talking about women. You and I both have a masculine and a feminine side. Like you, I've got a pretty strong feminine side. I love the flow of energy. I love connection. I love good communication. But I've also got a masculine side that I like getting shit done. Let's not talk about it. Let's do it. You know, so that's very masculine. But I've had to develop my masculine side quite a bit because I was pretty much trained to be more in my feminine. And a lot of men are. So the feminine is need. It's need, right? It needs to be filled externally. And if we haven't been taught how to surround ourselves with resources to help fill our own bucket, that's a masculine act. It's taking responsibility for my needs and my wants. And if we haven't done that, we're going to be pretty empty and needy. And then so if we go to the feminine creatures in our life, with this emptiness, it's like a big emotional hose. They're already a bigger feminine bucket with a bigger hole in the bottom. And like we come with this emotional hose and they're going like this. No, no, yo, stop. And what I discovered is that especially what men will do, especially in relationship, but even, you know, yeah, single guys do this, you know, in terms of trying to build relationship, men in relationship do it. One of the primary ways we know how to get our needs met is through sex. Oh, if you'll have sex with me, all my needs, everything's better. All my physical needs are met. My emotional needs are met. My social needs are met. I feel valuable. I feel loved. I feel desired. Oh, those are all feminine things. And we take that to, and maybe we're not getting our needs met for a connection with men. Maybe we're not living with purpose or passion in our life. Maybe we're, you know, I call it hanging out in the nursery. We're surfing the internet, playing video games, smoking dope, you know, jacking off to porn on the internet. And that doesn't fill the bucket up. I call that junk. That's all junk food. It doesn't fill us. So then we go to the woman with this big hose in the form of sexuality. But what it really is, here's our neediness right here. And we put a sexual desire on top of that. Go to a woman, if we're a single dude, it's to a woman, you know, we're trying to seduce. If it's to our girlfriend or wife, it's, you know, oh, you know, have sex with me, want me, desire me. And then the woman goes like that. And we think a couple of things. Well, my sex is bad. Women reject me for being sexual. No, it wasn't about the sex at all. It was about saying to this female creature, open and let me enter you with this big empty neediness and suck the living daylights out of you because I'm so empty. That's what they're going like that to, not the sexuality. It's the needy. That's why it's repulsive to the feminine. The feminine wants to be filled, not drained. It already feels caretaken. Empty enough. And not caretaken. And that's why I say that this takes a while for people to grasp, but I say that the masculine is love. The masculine is a source of love. The feminine is the consumer or seeker of love. And I say the masculine source of love, like if you go to Scott Peck's definition of love, is basically intention and action for one's or another's spiritual development or self-interest. Mm. Intention and action are masculine traits. So men, I say, have to learn to husband our own feminine, and we have to fill our own bucket up. Then we can fill the bucket up of the feminine around us. Now, once our bucket is full and overflowing, that becomes highly attractive to all things feminine.
Because the feminine
wants to be filled. Now, I say feminine is women, babies, dogs, cats. My where's Nala? She's sitting right behind me. She's usually right. It's my female pit bull. She's usually right here at my feet. She loves my masculine energy.
Yeah.
But money, opportunity, adventure, those are all feminine, right?
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And a statement that I'll make at times, and usually if I'm talking to like a female coach, female dating coach, and I'll say something like, the feminine is highly attracted to a man who's comfortable in his own skin, knows where he's going, and looks like he's having a good time going there. The female coaches always go, that's it. The feminine goes, that's a full man. I want that. I want that depth of connection. That full man can fill me. Now, of course, a woman has a masculine. She can husband her own feminine as well. But what I've noticed is a lot of times once women get into their masculine, they don't get out of it very easily. Once they get into that doing role, it's kind of like, I don't know if your wife's like this, but you start cleaning the house. You think, well, let's just straighten up here, or let's just clean up this room and then, you know, go for a walk or go for a drive or go see a movie. But the feminine starts cleaning the house and gets in that masculine. No, we're not stopping till the entire house is clean. Every toilet is scrubbed with a toothbrush. Everything's spotless. And the guy's just going, isn't it good enough? You know, and the woman's going, no, because it just seems like feminine goes into masculine. They don't come out easily. So that means a lot of women are walking around with big empty buckets.
Yeah.
Their own feminine side is not being nurtured. Yeah. And then if they get with kind of little boy, nice guys, and we're going, you know, indirectly and manipulatively, fill me, please, like me, love me, have sex with me, please. You know, and all of a sudden they're going, I got stuff to do. You know, it feels like almost one more masculine demand, you know, when we want to have sex.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really powerful, and I've definitely been that kind of young man that was having a virtue of being without needs. You talk about, you know, a nice guy. I still believe that it's important to come to a relationship not without need, but having fully met my need. And I feel like as I've done that over the last 3 to 5 years, things like getting up early, going to the gym, hanging around good masculine guys who are on, you know, grafting, good guys together, having a good counsel, ice baths, eating well, trying to be the best dad I can be, reading good books, having good conversations. Like 3 to 5 years later, I'm feeling the fruits of this dynamic that's now changed, right? Like
Your bucket's right? full.
I'm late 30s and my marriage is more on fire now, without being crude, than it's ever been. It's a paradox, right? I'm still the same guy, but I'm coming to the marriage in such a more, I guess, a grounded perspective.
And again, the feminine is highly attracted to that. The feminine wants to be opened by that. The feminine wants to submit to that. The feminine wants to be penetrated by that kind of conscious fullness, right? Masculine is all about the fullness. And the feminine is all about, you know, everything that's not nailed down. And it's drawn to that, what I'll call it, masculine frame. And a term that one of my clients used one time in a workshop that just I really liked. It's talking about creating the masculine frame for the feminine flow.
Right.
So you create the masculine frame of all those things you talk about.
Yeah.
Now the feminine, your own feminine flow, the muse, your creativity, your spontaneity, these great things you can create come once you've created the masculine frame for it, right?
Safety
and trust are essential for the feminine, and then the feminine can relax and open and be filled and be penetrated when there's that safety and trust. So when your feminine partner, when your own feminine, your own internal feminine sees, I can trust this guy, believe it or not, we can be misogynistic towards our own feminine. Our own feminine can go, I don't trust you, asshole. You're not safe. You don't have any structure. You don't have any discipline.
You're not
filled. And so the more you create the structures like what you created, your own feminine flourishes. And then the feminine around us flourishes as well because we're created that masculine frame for the feminine flow that gets expressed in creativity and just great, amazing, serendipitous, spontaneous. I wasn't looking for that kind of experiences.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think 1 plus 1 equals 3, meaning the masculine and the feminine. When we integrate those two, it brings forth new creation to the world, right? So I think, you know,
well, you see that the whole yin and yang diagram. Right. Yeah, there is an interdependence between, it's not like, oh, I'm just masculine or I'm just feminine. Yeah. There is a flow and an interconnectedness between them. And when they are consciously interconnected, it's amazing.
Well, John Gray from Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, he said on the podcast that when either men are too much in the feminine or women are too much in the masculine, hormonally, it's an addiction. It's almost
hormonally, it's an addiction.
There's something on a hormonal level in our biology that we become addicted to.
And it creates what I call a reverse polarity. And to have polarity, you have to have a masculine and feminine pole, right?
Yeah.
Now, I'm a big believer that, especially in modern relationships, the best relationships have a flux to them. There mm-hmm. is a flow where the two partners, and this would have been heterosexual relationships, gay relationships, lesbian relationships. If you look at gay and lesbian relationships, that masculine feminine polarity is usually more pronounced than even it is in most heterosexual relationships. Mm. You know, it's kind of like they know you need a pitcher and a catcher. You need a top and a bottom. You need polarity. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens, what I think where we can get dysfunctional and toxic is locking in, well, you're the guy, you have to be masculine all the time. Yeah, you're the girl, you have to be feminine all the time. Yeah. And we all do have a masculine and feminine energetic polarity. Yeah. I'm talking about energetic states here, not genitalia or mm-hmm. chromosomes. Energetic, and it is fluid. Mm-hmm. When I tell my wife, "Wait for me, I'll open your door," I'm in my masculine. She's submitting into her feminine, and she
willfully
likes that. Willfully, my wife is one of the strongest people you'd ever meet. She grew up 8 out of 10 in poverty in Guadalajara, Mexico.
Yeah.
Family abuse, neighbors beating her up, you know, abused by priests, abused by everybody. And she's tough. She's a gym rat. She goes in the gym 2 hours a day. She's done Muay Thai. She's done kickboxing. I don't mess with her. She's tough. She's masculine. She gets things done. When the cars need worked on, she takes the cars. When we need the carpenter, when we need the glass, I call her my mafiosa. I love getting her. She gets on the phone chewing these people out and says, "You said it was going to be here last week. When is it?" My husband says, "If it's not here today, to come down and get my deposit back." She's tough. She's tough. Yeah. And she's as feminine as she can be. She'll get down on the floor and you know, love on the pit bull and chew on the pit bull's face. And she loves it when she says, "I love it when you tell me no." We walk into a restaurant. We live in Mexico, and my wife doesn't speak much English at all. So I got to learn Spanish, which I was grateful for. We'll walk in a restaurant and the waiters will talk to her, of course, here in Mexico. And they'll go, "Should I give him a menu in English?" And she goes, "No, he just lives in Mexico. Give him the menu in Spanish." And I go, "Yeah, give my wife and kids the menu in English. They need to work on their English." then the waiter hands my wife the menu and she goes, "No, he's my boss. He'll order for me." And I joke, "Oh, I get to be the boss when she says I can't." You know, it's just this running shit that we've got. And she can order. Of course she can. She can open her own door. Like I said, she can get shit done like nobody's business. But she loves it when she comes to me and asks, when she holds up two outfits, "Which one, honey?" You know, I go, "Oh, they both look good. Either one." No, she doesn't want that.
100%.
She wants me to kind of, you know, use my spidey sense and know which one she's really wanting to wear.
Right.
And show up. And maybe it's usually even three outfits most of the time. You know, three I've never seen before. And I'm going, they all look good. I know she wants to wear all three of them, but she wants to wear one more than the other. And I go, "Yeah, I like the black one." And if her face...
We have to drop the martial arts. We have to drop the martial arts in the brain, don't we? We have to go, we have to drop this idea of what is she wanting me to say versus what do I genuinely think? Because that's going to build the trust in our opinion.
Yeah, and then I go, and then if she puts something on and comes out and she goes, "Do you like it?" And I tell you what, if you don't, you better tell her.
You better
say, "You know, it's not the best look on you." And they're going, they're a little disappointed. They go, "You're right. I need to change." But if you said, "Oh, baby, it looks good. It looks fine. It looks great. I know it's a new outfit. I know." But if you say, "It's not your best look," 100%. Then they trust you.
Exactly. Takes a brave man. This is something I've definitely learned. Like, it creates that initial, "Oh, damn you, asshole." But the bits after, she's like, when I give that compliment, oh, there you go. That's just how
that's it. That's the one.
I've often found, particularly in a parenting situation, if my wife and I are fighting for the middle ground of polarity, we both lose. Everybody loses, right?
We're there is no middle ground. Yeah.
Right. I found that
Let me say one last thing. Let me finish that last thought.
Go on.
Then we'll come back. Polarity is not determined by, you know, your chromosomes or your genitalia. Mm. But what I do believe that if the most fundamentally masculine person in the relationship tends to take responsibility for setting the setting the tone and taking the lead, it gets the ball rolling. And I tell guys, when I talk to men about setting the tone and leading in relationship, they go, okay, Dr. Glover, I know you say take control. I go, no. You'll never hear me use the word take control. It's hard enough to control ourselves, let alone control a person or situation. I say lead. And all that really means is just get the ball rolling, show up with an idea, have at least the beginnings of a plan and say, hey, babe, how about we go get Chinese tonight? Rather than saying, what do you want to do tonight, dear?
In general,
women, I've listened to women for over 25 years in counseling.
Yes.
Women hate that. Women hate that. I come home from work. I've been dealing with the kids all day. I've been around. And he puts one more decision on me that I got to make. And
yes.
They go, just tell us what we're going to do and what you want me to wear. And let's go do it. Now, the men will say, well, do I have to be the lead all the time? Do I have to always set the tone? And I go, no, you don't. But let's accept it as your default role. It's like you're on the dance floor. If you don't lead on the dance floor, she's got nothing to follow.
Yeah.
But in healthy reciprocal relationships, like I said, my wife's strong. You know, I give, hey, honey, make the decision on that. You know, whatever you think's best. And then sex, you know, sexual polarity, you do have to have a doer and a done too, right? Mm. Otherwise, it's not sex. It's two people lying next to each other waiting for something to happen. So there's got to be a dominant and submissive pole, pitcher, catcher. Mm. But in good sex, that trades off, right?
Yeah.
But I found that in most things relationship-wise, if the more default masculine character gets the ball rolling through proactive action, the feminine, more feminine, opens and follows. But, you know, he or she still has enough of a masculine that they have their wants. Can we do it this way? Or, hey, I'm getting on top now. You know, whatever it may be. But something's got to get that ball rolling, and it's the masculine pole that gets things moving.
Yeah, it's really interesting in a relationship dynamic. You know, the particularly many women that I've had the pleasure of speaking to over the years, they've developed coping mechanisms to deal with a less masculine partner, shall we say?
Uh-huh.
And
I've heard a lot of that.
Yeah, so they've had to take the lead more often. But the paradox then is when she takes the lead, is more responsible for his development than he is. Like, there's just this jarring. I think John Gray likened it to saying that if a woman can love a man for as he is, he will go and improve himself. If you try and change a man, it feels very unloving because you're not accepting of who he is in this moment. Like, you must have had these conversations.
There's one
more
piece to it. Oh, yeah. But there's another piece to it. If I heard David Data say one time, if a woman tells a man what to do and he does it, she just polarized him into his feminine.
Mm.
Okay. So here's the thing. Let's say your wife loves you and wants you to be your best. She can see your potential. Mm-hmm. She would not have married you. She would not have started dating you at 15. You were just a boy, but she saw your potential. And the feminine will go to the bank on potential. It really will. And so she saw your potential. She sees what you can be. And when you're anything less than that, it's painful for her. It hurts her. Mm. Not only because she loves you and she sees you being less than you could be, it also means she has to raise her masculine up.
Right.
And I will often say, most women can be the strongest person in the room, but most don't want to be, at least not all the time, and at least not with their partner, right? So, but here's the we talk about paradoxes again. She loves you and she says, hon, you really need to work on this. You really need to pay attention to this. Like I said, my wife's a gym rat. I'm not. I like to take care of myself. I like to be in good health and good shape. We have a gym in our house. We have Olympic weights. We got a spin bike. We have TRX. We got punching bag. We got dumbbells. We got kettlebells. We got everything. And, you know, I got to make myself walk out of my office around the corner into the gym. You know, she works out here at the house, then walks to another gym where they've got other equipment she wants. Mm. And so, you know, when I don't work out regularly, it hurts her trust because she knows I know I need to work out regularly. It's even worse if I say, oh, yeah, I'm going to work out today. And then I don't get to it. That's like me telling her a lie. Right. And she'll see, oh, how can I trust anything else? He says he's going to go to the gym and he doesn't. How can I trust? So there's all of that. But the bigger piece is she knows I'm better than that. She knows what I'm capable of. She sees me. She tells me all the time, you know, in Spanish, Robert, you're grande. Tú eres mejor. You're a big man. She sees men come to my house for workshops here and they praise me to her. She's heard me speak in public and she said, you're a big man. You're great. You're amazing. She sees that. And then when she sees me play small or not live up to that, it hurts her. Okay. But now here's the flip. If I go to the gym because I know she's going to be upset at me if I don't, or if I'm doing it just to please her, or I'm doing it because I don't want her on my case.
Yep.
I've been polarized into my feminine. She's actually setting the tone and I'm following that lead and responding. Now, that may be not a bad thing on occasion. You know, okay, it got me started. It got me in here. But you know what? I need to keep going to the gym because it's for me. It's good for me. I need the discipline. I need the structure. I need everything that does. Then all of a sudden, my wife will respond to that.
Yes.
That masculine, powerful part of me. But if I keep working on me in any way, okay, I'm going to work on this. I'm going to go to a men's group because she told me to. I'm going to go to therapy because I'm going to read books because she told me to. I'm going to try to be the good man she wants me to be. You're actually still in your feminine seeking external validation and praise and acceptance, and you'll never get it. That'll never make her happy. Mm. At some point, you got to do it on your terms because you know that it's in a sense, you require it of you. You know, the universe requires it of you. You know, your fate requires it of you. Then your wife's going, that's the man I fell in love with when he was 15. I saw that in him back then.
Well, and that's the bit I was kind of getting at with the polarity in the middle ground. The more that we step into our polarity, the more we realize the absolute value that we inherently bring that each other just isn't there to provide. You know, there's something uniquely in this and something uniquely in this. Rather than you expect me to be this and I expect you to be that, how about we just be the brightest versions of us both? And that actually pulls us further apart, but actually makes it so much more connected.
Yeah. And you mentioned parenting, and that's a good place to look at it. As I said, my doctorate in training is marriage and family therapy. So even though marriage therapy was kind of my wheelhouse, I did a lot of family counseling as well. And I would tell parents, you know, the job of healthy, conscious parents is to protect the child from the other parent. It may sound a little bit weird at first, but you know, the context of it is you got flaws in you as a parent. Your wife has flaws in her as a parent. I tell people, most people parent either exactly the same way our parents parented, heaven forbid, or the exact opposite of the way our parents parented, which is not healthy either. You know, the opposite of crazy is still crazy. And so you're just reacting. You're not giving your child what your child needs. So you're going to bring your parenting and your temperament. Your wife's going to bring her temperament, her parenting. And you both bring value to that parenting team. But you also bring some baggage. And your job is to help protect the children from her baggage in a loving way that doesn't throw her under the bus.
Yes.
Her job is to protect the kids from your baggage in a loving way that doesn't throw them under the bus.
Yes.
A pretty common parenting pattern. I've raised kids in three families. My biological son in my first marriage, two stepkids in my second marriage, two more stepkids in my third marriage. This is kind of fun now because my two stepkids don't speak English. They're in school. They're 18 and 16 now. I came into their life about 10 years ago. But they're the same age as my granddaughter. So in a way, I kind of get to bring kind of grandfather love to my stepkids. Mm-hmm. Mainly because I couldn't speak their language when I first came into their life. So I just loved them a lot. You know. Mm. So what usually happens in my parenting systems with the women I get with, the women tend to be, for lack of a better term, the yellers. You know, the ones that, you know, start screaming at the kids and go on and on, just verbal barrage. gosh. And you know, the kids after a while learn to just tune it out. They really do. Where and I'm a little bit more of, you know, I don't want the kids mad at me. I don't want them upset. I want them, but so I can be, you know, I've been accused of, well, you're trying to befriend the kids and, you know, make them like you. And probably there's some of that. I probably bring some of that. But another piece that I also bring is that calmness. And also all my four stepkids that I've raised in two different marriages would rather get disciplined by me than by their biological mother. Because, you know, mother's coming in, you know, hot. Yeah. And they're going, here we go again. They're checking their watch. How long do I have to listen to mom going off on it? And then, you know, finally later on, I'll butter mom up a little bit and it'll all get back to good. My approach is I say, okay, listen, we're not going to do it that way. I mean, I'm talking to them about that. Look, we're not going to do it that way. Here's how we're going to do it. You understand? If you continue to do it that way, there'll be consequences. You understand? Do we need to talk about what those consequences are? Okay. So you understand where we're at? Yeah. My conversation's 45 seconds at the most. Calm with clarity of here's how we're going to do it. It's very masculine. It's going to be done within this frame. Understand? And the kids go, And then you know, my wives would always go, oh, you always got to be the nice guy. And you know, instead of you know, arguing that, I'll just go, no, it's okay. It's okay. They understood me. They understood where I'm at. And the other little piece that I would do, like when my wife's helping my stepdaughter with her math, my daughter's terrible at math. And my wife, you know, they're at the table and I'm in my office and I hear my wife's voice getting louder and louder and louder and louder. And I go, that's not helping somebody who's not good at math. I know, because I wasn't good at math. And instead of walking in and telling my wife, you need to quit yelling at her, that's not helping her at all.
Right.
I've told my wife, I said, listen, if I hear your voice getting louder, I'm going to walk in and give you a kiss and turn around, and walk away. That's my way of communicating. I don't think you getting loud is helping without throwing my wife under the bus.
Sure.
And it, and you know, and my, every time my wife, she'll take a breath.
There's a conscious
Her,
reset.
it goes down a little bit. So that's what we can do as parents. We don't have to be the same. It's better that we're not the same,
But
but
there's
we can be a
grace.
team.
There's grace for that. And I think that's such a, because I think it's hard when you have an enemy behind the lines, right? The opposite of what you're talking about is you're being attacked for your humanity, attacked for your vulnerability and flaws, which increases the nice guy hide all the, you know, the resentment or
Yeah, because you know what I've seen in so many families is, you know, that enemy behind the line. The wife doesn't think the husband's on her side. The husband doesn't think the so what they do is they both go to further extremes.
Right.
You know,
And the kids get right in the middle and exploit them.
oh, the kids get triangulated. And the kids either then act out in that triangulated way or they take advantage of it. They know which one to, you know, so, you know, mommy gets more overprotective. Daddy gets more angry. And when he sees mom being overprotective and coddling, he gets even angry and angry at her. And when she sees him angry all the time, she gets even more overprotective. And they're just reenacting their own childhood stuff. We all do. We all do. But yeah, that enemy behind the line, I like that. That all of a sudden, now we can protect our kids from the other without the other being the enemy. We're still a team.
100%,
We're still a
100%.
team.
Love that. Conscious of time, want to be super respectful of your time. We have definitely got the ears of people that have listened through to the end. There is either a woman here that's going, oh, my husband or my partner's a nice guy, or you've got a guy that might go, yeah, this might be me. So what one tip do you have for the guy, and what one tip do you have for the woman to do next as a result of listening to this conversation?
Besides buy any of my books, you
All
know,
of the books, all
all
of the
the books.
podcasts. Yeah.
You go buy everything I sell. That's where you start.
100%. Download everything. Yeah.
So, you know what? Here's what I start with every nice guy is go find safe people. You can't do this alone. So, for example, if you start doing your nice guy work trying to please women or a woman, you're still in a nice guy mode. You're still seeking external validation. You're still accepting the feminine story of what you should be. Go find safe people. We need safe people to start releasing that toxic shame we internalized as a child. Oftentimes, we don't even know it's there. I didn't know it's there until I started opening it up in a 12-step group. That's so powerful.
And toxic shame
Find
is just that belief that it's not okay to be who I am.
to be me. Yeah, I'm not good enough. I'm bad. I'm unlovable. Again, we try to put words to it, but it's an emotional belief. I'm broken. I'm not good enough, whatever. And then we put behaviors and thoughts and actions and wants and wishes and impulses on top of that, that makes me bad. Well, no, we just believe we're bad. So we need a safe place to begin revealing ourselves, being supported to take on a new paradigm, getting more accurate feedback. No, you're not bad. Like, you know, if a guy gets in a group and, you know, a group of men and they start talking and about, you know, a few weeks in, one of them reveals, you know, I'm really embarrassed to share this, but, you know, I got a problem with porn. You know, nobody's mentioned porn, you know, up till now. One guy mentions it, got so much shame, feels so bad, so defective, so sinful, so evil. Maybe his wife's found it. She's, you know, going, maybe just whatever. And then all of a sudden, after the guy's listening to him a little bit, yeah, me too. All of a sudden, hey, I've got that. Whatever the issue is, now it's when we got a commonality. We don't feel defective. We don't feel broken. We feel normal. We feel like, okay, I got stuff I can work on. Doesn't make me bad.
So the question I got asked recently was, okay, well, the integration, you're becoming an integrated man, is about accepting all of that. What is the next practical bit? Because it's not like, okay, well, we accept the flaw in our humanity, so we continue the behavior. Where does the psychology of a man go? Because you're not saying, oh, it's fine, we'll just accept that behavior, we'll integrate and we'll just carry on the behavior.
Well, that's another paradox there. And it's actually right here in my t-shirt.
Yeah.
You know, the men's program that I've started, and we launched in July of 23, the motto, mantra that I tagged on it, a tagline, whatever, is good men doing better. And I phrase that very specifically on purpose because we're okay. We're not bad. We're not flawed. We're not evil. And we tend to associate our behaviors with our identity. You know, you know, as a friend of mine told me one time, he said, Robert, you can be a real dick, but you're not a dick.
Right.
And until you can integrate those two, you know, okay, I can be a dick. I know
I
can.
Love that.
I can be judgmental. Yeah. I can be critical, but that's not me. That's not who I am. That's a behavior.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we can integrate that. I can accept that I can be a dick, but I'm not a dick. That's integration. So I'm a good man. I don't have to become a better man to be loved. I don't become a different man to be loved or accepted or valued.
But I can
do better. Yeah. I can notice when I'm being a dick. I've got a little wristband and it just says do better. And this is from my program. Just do better. I can listen better. I can be more patient. I can set a better boundary. I can face fears better. I can be bolder. Yeah. We can all level up through doing better in a conscious, non-judgmental way of self. All right, say I lost it in that situation. Now, if I go into a shame attack, I'm not going to learn anything from it. I'm just going to feel shame and try to repress the behaviors that led to that rather than learn from it. Yeah. And then anything you repress is either going to come out down here or come puking out again later. It'll happen. But if I go, okay, I'm not real proud of that behavior, how could I have done that better? Well, I could have listened more. I could have gotten my feet grounded. I could have breathed. So the paradox is we can be good men.
Yes.
We don't have to become better men, different men, but we can do better. And one of my coaches gave me a quote the other day by, I don't think he was a saint, but I think he was a religious writer, you know, a few hundred years ago. And I'd never heard this before. And I really liked it. Like I said, I'm not religious, but I do have a you know, I know there's something, right? And the quote was, the glory of God is man fully alive. I love that quote. The glory of God, what do you say? Yes. The glory of the cosmos, the glory of creation is creation fully alive, man fully alive. So that's man doing better. And to go back to your question, I think we men need other men. We need tribe. We need our posse. We need men that we can reveal ourselves to, be vulnerable with, be supported by, be held accountable by, be sharpened by. So that's when you ask the number one thing I recommend to men, don't do it alone. Go find a coach, therapist, men's group, preferably 12-step group where you're surrounded by males, conscious men, conscious masculine energy, and start sharpening, leveling up, not by being better, not by, you know, by, oh, if I get, as soon as I get rid of my porn addiction, I'll be a better person.
Yeah.
No, you're not a bad person for having a porn addiction. but you can do better. You can be more conscious, more transparent, more authentic. Those are the things we can work on and do better, not in the goal of being better, but just being our best self.
As a byproduct, 100%. Yeah, I love that. I think Jesus said that he came so that we may live life to the fullest. And it kind of is what came up when you were speaking. And I don't think the church have done a good job of emasculating a Jesus that seems to be meek. I think if that guy
there's a whole nother podcast.
Right, 100%. Yeah,
like,
I'm not going to...
Like I said, I'm not religious, but I do believe in the story of Jesus. And and I do have 2 degrees in religion, so I can talk, and I've lived it, so I can talk intelligently about, you know, just like even just quickly. When I was a youth minister, we had a joy bus program where we went out and picked the little kids up and brought them to church, and they called it Joy. And the acronym was Jesus first, other second, yourself last. And I thought, did they ever read the New Testament? Did they ever like listen to Jesus? Jesus, when people ask Jesus, what is the greatest law? And he said, love God with all your heart. And he said, the second one is just like it. So it's not different. It's not a second law. And he said, love your neighbor as yourself. You know, does anybody ever listen to that? What is the standard of all love? It's self-love. You can't love anyone more than you love yourself. You can't let anybody love you more than you love yourself. But yet we're supposed to be putting everybody else first and ourselves last. Jesus didn't say that. Mm-hmm. Now, he did talk about sacrifice, and but that's an act of self. Anyway, that's a whole another podcast.
100%. Yeah.
You did ask me another question about what can women do if they have a nice guy
please.
Partner.
Yeah.
Okay. This is tough because we've already talked about why this one's tough. There's this paradox. If the woman tells the man what to do and he does it, she just polarized him into his feminine. And probably the woman doesn't want him to be more feminine. You know, I saw one of those years ago, one of those internet kind of joke memes about, you know, what the woman can and can't do in a relationship. And one of them was the woman can tell the man what to do or tell him how to do it, but she can't do both. Right. That's you know, off limits. You can't tell you should do that and you should do it this way. Right. She just polarized him into his feminine. If he does it, he's totally in his feminine, even if he's in a doing mode. There's strings attached. So this is difficult. Women ask me this all the time because I think women are sensitive to this. If I tell him you need to go work on your nice guy stuff, I want you to man up. I want you to set the tone and lead. I want you to quit burdening me with all the decisions. And he goes, yes, dear, tell me how to do that. How should I do that? She goes, no. Woman will get it. They're sensitive to it. And I tell women, you know, actually probably the extent of what you can do is say, hey, I heard a podcast today. This book sounds really good. I thought you might like it. You know, here, read it if you want. I think you'll like it. You know, you use all your feminine, you know, seductive, you know, tools to at least get him to open no more Mr. Nice Guy. Okay. Then, you know, if he does start, you know, reading, applying it, don't get too nosy. What did you learn? You know, what are you getting out of it? Can you see yourself in there? Now, all of a sudden, you know, he's like, he's in school having to, you know, go up to the blackboard and say, yeah, I understood this concept. I get it. But the feminine does know how to subtly reinforce, positively reinforce behaviors. Oh, I love it when you tell me no. Oh, you know how good that felt when you actually just told me what we're going to do instead of asking me? You know, it's just that. Don't go on and on and on about it because all that'll ruin it. But just that one sentence. Oh, thanks for doing that. You know what? I felt really safe when you stepped up in that way. Or, you know, I really appreciated the way you handled the kids in that situation. Like you said, you like those words of praise. Most men will respond well to that positive affirmation of a job well done. Men, I think the masculine is all about job well done, living masterfully. Now, we don't need the praise. We know when we've done it well, but the praise doesn't hurt. The little bit of, I saw that. That was good. So that's what I'd say to the women. You're going to have to use a lot of subtlety, a lot of nuance. You can't get the big stick out, you know. Couples would come to my office, with obviously a nice guy and a woman who loved the man, but was tired of his nice guy behaviors. And she's been telling him his covert contract, his lack of boundaries, his lack of decision-making or leadership. She's been telling him this, you know, you know, yelling at him about it, sulking about it, withdrawing about it, fighting about it. They come to my office and I start talking to him about boundaries and leadership.
Sure.
And you know, these traits we've been talking about. Yeah. And the guy goes, Oh, yeah, I think I understand what you're talking about. I see that. And now the woman looks at him and basically, you know, what the hell? I've been telling you this for years and you ignore me, you argue with me, or you say yes, dear, and don't do it.
The
expert, a man tells you once and you go, okay, I get that. And I look at the woman, okay, I understand you. I understand you've been telling them this. I said, you're his muse. You see it, you feel it, you get it all the way into your nervous system. Mm-hmm. And I go, we guys are slower. And I'll tell them, it takes the big stick, usually from a guy, because he's not dependent on my approval to know if he's going to have sex later on tonight, right? He is dependent on your approval to know if we can have sex later on tonight. So I said, you know, we've taken that out of the equation. So I can hit him with the big stick and he'll get it. So I said, do that subtle reinforcement. Oh, I'm so glad you got that.
And it allows her to fulfill the role that's irreplaceable, which is the wife. It allows her just to be the wife in a relationship rather than the mother as well.
Oh, well, there's another podcast of the women.
I'm trying to wrap up here. Of the women
having to mother their women do not want to mother their boyfriends or husbands. But again, that was kind of where we started this conversation of men needing that kind of validation from the woman.
I am super grateful of your work, super grateful for your time. We have a word here at Always Betting Yesterday. It's called heartprint. And the word really symbolizes the legacy of our work. It's the legacy, it's the ripple effect. Dr. Robert, what do you hope that your legacy, what do you hope your heartprint will be?
I live in that every day. I'm very conscious I'm 68 years old. I've had a couple of near-death experiences in the last 6 years. I know it's out there, you know, like Carlos Castaneda wrote, you know, keep death right here on your left side. Know that it's there. Let it be your companion and let that guide you right in life. And so that's part of growing up is, no, I'm going to die. And I love it when I get emails, when I go on podcasts and people say, Robert, thank you for your book. I love your book. It changed my life. You know, that book represents my own personal work. It represents, you know, 6 to 7 years of labor of writing, 3 years to get it published, 20 something years. Still to this day, I am talking to people promoting, you know, what I've done. And when I launched Integration Nation, when I started working on it a couple of years ago, the deeper I got into it, I thought, you know, I should be maybe retiring, you know, in my mid 60s, but I thought, I'm not ready. And I thought, somebody said, Robert, you need to create a men's membership program and put everything you've ever created in it give men a pathway through it. And I thought, you know what? If I die and everything I've ever created is just in a Dropbox folder somewhere, I've done a disservice to the world. I'm here and I've started really to believe a lot more in fate over the last couple of years. That my fate is you and I having this conversation right now and other things that will grow out of that I can't see, you can't see, we can't know. Other doors will open up. Other people will be affected. That's my legacy. So about a year and a half ago, kind of, I thought I can't launch a new business and keep thinking I might semi-retire in the near future. And I thought, you know me, I swear a little bit, fuck it. I'm in it for the next 20 years. I'm in it for 20 more years. I'm bringing my A game. I'm bringing, you know, my youth energy, not my, I'm close to retirement energy.
Right.
And, you know, people tell me all the time, Robert, I love your energy. You got more energy than guys half your age. And because I believe in what I'm doing. And even though I'm building a business, I'm learning so much. I'm swimming in deeper waters than I've ever swam as a businessman. But beyond that, my message has permeated the world already.
Yeah.
And I really believe what I teach and what men need is on the cusp of blowing up at even a bigger level. That's my legacy. So whether I live another 2 years, another 20 years, another 30 years, I really hope to leave behind a changed world that changed because I helped men change one man at a time. I helped men do better. And when men do better, it changes the world. I'll just tell you a quick story. And then I got invited a couple of years ago to go down to Costa Rica and be the guest speaker at a retreat center that's an ayahuasca retreat center. I'd never done ayahuasca, never done psychedelics. And I went and you know, they wanted to be an influencer. It was a men's week. And they had a shaman there. And this shaman, he was great. It was the fourth night. I didn't know that, and they had a different shaman every night for every ceremony. There were four ceremonies. And the fourth night goes all night long. And I didn't know that the shaman even knew who I was. I was just one of many guys in this room. And he gave me a blessing at the end. And he put his arms around me, around my neck. And he just got close to my ear. And he said, what you're doing is amazing. Because if we're going to change the world, we got to change the men. We got to start with the men. And he said, so keep doing what you're doing. And then he said three times, you're not alone. You're not alone. You're not alone. I still get tears in my eyes. That was so moving. That just put it in perspective. We work on one man at a time, one man a little bit more conscious, one man a little bit more open-hearted, one man a little bit aware, one man doing better, one man connecting deeper with other men, one man being more loving, more conscious, more leading with his partner, with his children. We're changing the world. That's my legacy.
Oh, let's go. I'm here for it. Dr. Robert, what an honor and privilege for this conversation. I'll put all your good links in the show notes, and I'd be honored if you'd lead us with a final thought from your good self.
A final thought from my good self. I'll go back to what I said a little bit earlier. Don't try to do this alone, right? We're built to need tribe. We're built to need to be part of a team. We'll be at our best. We'll play at our best with good teammates surrounding us. So don't do it alone.
Brother, I appreciate you.
Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for this great call. I'll get up at 7:30 anytime to have this talk with you. Actually, I'll start at 7:30. I'll get up before then to have this conversation anytime.
Love it.
Hey, my friends, thank you for making it to the end. I hope that our time spent together today has left you a little bit better than before you push play. I'd really appreciate if you just took a moment to leave a review to allow me to meet more people where they are and hopefully leave them a little bit better too. If you're curious to know how I, through Always Better Than Yesterday, can serve you, your team, your organization, then head to alwaysbetterthanyesterday.com to connect. And while you're there, let me know one or two things that you're going to do as a result of listening to this conversation. I absolutely love hearing your thoughts, your reflections, and the things that this spark in your own heart and mind. If you want more insights from my heart and mind, I do send out short episodes on a Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday, and again, I hope that they serve you well. I appreciate you listening. I'm Ryan Hartley, host of the Always Better Than Yesterday podcast, a podcast for heart-centered leaders just like you. Keep leading, my friends. Always love.